Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent has been speaking with Iowans about the presidential caucus in their state, and he'll share his findings. Do our personal biases influence who we vote for?
We have a partisan brain, and the problem is the world out there isn't partisan. The world out there is just the world.
A report that Saudi Arabia has arrested alleged terrorists, some of whom are said to be Americans. And a new film from Korean-American director So Young Kim. It's right here on The Voice of America. After months of campaigning and debates, voters in the U.S. state of Iowa are about to have the first say in the 2016 race for president. Iowans will turn out today to vote in party caucus meetings and express their preferences for president. In the weeks leading up to today's vote, a massive U.S. political apparatus has descended upon the state. Politicians, pollsters, reporters, and one of those reporters is our own Bill Gallo, and he's on the line. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Say, aren't people out there getting a little tired of this?
Well, yeah, here's the thing. Whenever you first get on the ground here in Iowa, and you go to campaign events, rallies, and things, you initially interact with a lot of people who are, you know, rightfully proud to be the first state in the nation to vote. They're very engaged, involved in the political process. And then once you leave the rallies and just start talking to ordinary people, you find that others just are not. They're tired of it. They've done this for weeks. Everywhere you look, there are ads. It's nonstop, and they just can never check out.
What have they said to you about it?
Well, you know, okay, so I've traveled across Iowa the last few days, and it's interesting. The complaints kind of vary according to the region. Here in Des Moines, a lot of people are just tired of the campaign events and the rallies, and the TV ads are one main complaint here. To get a sense of how many ads there are, one evening news station, that's about whenever they do their evening news, it's about a half-hour show. There's about 14 political ads during that show. So, I mean, it's almost more ads than TV shows. People are saying they want their TV back. Out in the more rural areas, it's more to do with pollsters, because landlines are more common, and pollsters, polling organizations, prefer to talk to people via landline. I talked to one guy. He said he answers the phone 5 times every night, and he answers the phone every time. He dutifully, you know, responds to the questions, is a good citizen about it, but he's exasperated. He says he just can never stop thinking.
I've heard that some people, though, go through a little bit of withdrawal after the vote, and then they're left all alone.
Right, yeah. One lady I talked to at a laundromat in Des Moines here said she just can't wait till Tuesday when everyone leaves and all the journalists leave and all the campaign ads, you know, are done. But then she kind of added at the end, well, I'm sure we'll hear about it for 5 days on the news about who won anyway. So there's no end in sight, sadly, for a lot of Iowans.
Well, while I've got you on the line, let me ask you in general, how do they feel about this balloting going on?
Well, you know, most of them are very excited about the process, from what I can tell. Like I said at the beginning of our conversation, there are plenty of people who are very interested and engaged, and they find this campaign particularly interesting given the, I guess you could say, unique non-establishment candidate. Everyone has an opinion, I'll say that.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Bill, for talking with us today.
Thanks, Susan.
For a look at what's going on the web today concerning Iowa, I'm joined here at the anchor desk by social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. So as we were talking about just before I came on, there's almost too much information out there because you have all of the different candidates have their own hashtags. You have hashtag Iowa caucus, hashtag IA caucus. So there's really a lot of information going on. But one thing that we are seeing is that the candidates are making a final push on social media to reach out to those voters. Donald Trump just released a video on Facebook, not a, you know, new TV ad or anything. It's a Facebook video where he's appealing to people and saying, come out and caucus tonight. So you really see the power of social media there to try to reach out to these audiences.
Yeah, it's interesting. The politicians have not missed a clue on this, using social media to get their points out.
Oh, not at all. And it's become a new thing now where just as you have TV advertising and you have mailers or, you know, things that people hang on the doorknobs, you have social media advertising now. And it's so targeted. You can reach out to very, very specific groups of people by things even as silly as TV shows, favorite, you know, types of food. But you can target down that specifically on social media, something that advertisers would love to do with television, but it's such a broad medium that it goes out to everyone. Social media is not like that. You can have social media ads that only go out to people that you really think will caucus, and that really helps the campaigns. In addition to the campaigns, we're seeing a lot of people asking, what is a caucus? That's something that people
Yeah, well, it's a little different.
It is a little different. So people trying to explain that as best they can on social media. The journalists are trying to explain it as best they can. The people on the other side are trying to understand it the best they can. But it's, you know, kind of giving us a sense of this microcosm of Iowa. It really is this unique situation, the unique caucus, and then the unique having all the candidates there in a relatively small state. And one thing I'm interested to see tonight as the caucus takes place is if social media plays into that, if people live tweet as they're caucusing or even do live video with things like Periscope or Facebook video streaming.
It'll be interesting tomorrow.
Yes, oh, for sure. Lots of social media reaction tomorrow.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A newly published study suggests that due to human activity, Earth is entering an age of plastic, as our planet's waters and land will be buried in layers of plastic waste by mid-century. The study's lead author, Jan Zalaschwitz, says that discarded plastic can be found everywhere, from the tops of mountains to deep beneath the oceans. Despite its increased use, plastics don't degrade as easily as natural materials like paper and wood. According to the World Watch Institute, nearly 300 million tons of plastic are made every year. It was reported that in the U.S. alone, only 7% of all plastics generated in 2009 was recycled, with the remainder deposited in landfills and elsewhere. The study suggests that plastic will have a long-lasting impact on Earth's geology as it becomes a part of the soil and eventually a unique part of its strata. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
A Saudi newspaper has reported that authorities there have arrested 9 American citizens and 24 other people as terror suspects during the past week. The arrests included 14 Saudis, 3 Yemenis, 2 Syrians, an Indonesian, a Filipino, an Emirati, a Kazakhstan national, and a Palestinian, the Saudi Gazette said. It did not say if any of what it called the terror suspects were linked to the Islamic State group, which has claimed responsibility for several deadly attacks against security forces and Shiites in the kingdom in recent months. The Saudi Gazette said some 532 Islamic State suspects accused of plotting attacks in the kingdom are being questioned ahead of their trial at the criminal court in Riyadh. To get reaction to the report of Americans being held, we go to our State Department correspondent, Pam Dawkins, who's on the phone with us. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you.
Well, Pam, what is the reaction over there to this story?
Well, the State Department is saying that the U.S. is aware of these reports alleging that several U.S. citizens were detained in Saudi Arabia. In a statement today, the State Department said it takes its obligation to assist U.S. citizens abroad seriously, but it also said that due to privacy concerns that it could not comment any more on these particular cases.
Do they know anything more about this particular case?
Well, there is a lot that remains unclear. First of all, the nature of their arrests remains unclear. One of the questions that I posed to State was whether or not there was an Islamic State connection. Also, the reports of these arrests have come on the heels of a Friday attack on a Shiite mosque in Saudi Arabia that killed 4 people. There are questions on whether or not it might be linked to that incident.
Well, what are relations like right now between the United States and Saudi Arabia? We've had a long-time relationship with them.
Absolutely. Generally, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have good relations. They are currently cooperating on several fronts. Both are, of course, part of the International Syria Support Group, which has been backing talks for a political transition in Syria. As a matter of fact, Secretary of State Kerry has just wrapped up a trip that included a stop in Riyadh to talk with Saudi officials about this and other issues. Also, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have been cooperating in Yemen, where the government has been battling Houthi rebels. Now, there has been some concern that Saudi support of the U.S. may wane as a result of the Iran nuclear deal and regional concerns that an empowered, sanctions-free Iran will be destabilizing to the region. But time will tell if this will come into play.
Well, I was curious, just in general terms, a case like this, would there be an extradition or would there be a prisoner exchange if these people are found guilty and they are truly Americans? What is the next step in this? Would the State Department contact the Saudi government?
I would imagine there is direct contact with the Saudi government, especially considering that there are good relations between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. As far as the next step, it's hard to say. It depends on the nature of the charges and what role, if any, the Americans had in these alleged acts of terrorism.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today, Pam. I should mention that you were on that State Department trip over there to Riyadh.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Well, thanks, Pam, for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, using our brain to avoid being conned by politicians, and a new movie, Love Song. We recently took a look at politicians wooing supporters with their smooth-talking ways. Author Rick Schenkman has written a book about it called Political Animals: How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Today we continue our conversation. Welcome, Rick. Do our personal biases get in the way of clear thinking? Because we all have them.
We sure do. We have a partisan brain, as a neuroscientist, Drew Weston, has argued. What this means is that when we confront information politically, it comes into our brain, and what do? If it is something that confirms an existing belief, we immediately accept it, and it goes into a certain compartment of our brain, and we integrate it in with all of our other knowledge. If it is upsetting information, it's contrary to our belief, then what we do is we shunt it aside, we ignore it, and when Drew Weston put subjects in an experiment, in an MRI. He conducted an experiment where he took the Bush voters of 2004 and he gave them information that was positive to them. You could see on the MRI that neurons were activating in one part of the brain. And when he gave these Bush voters information that was contrary to Bush, that made him out to be a hypocrite, that activated a different set of neurons. And basically, what those neurons were doing was saying, this is information that I don't want to really have to deal with, so I'm going to shun it over here and ignore it. And this isn't just for Bush voters. They also did the same experiment with Kerry voters, John Kerry voters, back in 2004, and the exact same thing happened. So we have a partisan brain. And the problem is the world out there isn't partisan. The world out there is just the world. And if you wind up interpreting the world through your partisan lens, well, you're not going to really understand what is happening in the real world. So we have to guard against these biases. And you know what? It's very, very difficult. But as long as you're aware of how your own brain is working, and it's doing all this automatically, you're not thinking about it. This is how the brain works. Then you have this conclusion that, well, I guess I have to second-guess myself. And you know what? We're not used to second-guessing ourselves. With our instincts, we go on instinct. We feel good when we do. So what I'm recommending is that we do something that doesn't come naturally to us.
Should the way politicians conduct their business be changed, or is that an impossibility?
Well, that's an impossibility as long as you're going to have a mass democracy. They're going to stand up, and they're going to try to get us going by saying things that are going to activate our evolved psychological mechanisms. That's the way that the social scientists refer to the way our brain takes in information and processes it, like back in the Stone Age period. So when Donald Trump is running around and he's talking about immigrants, Mexican immigrants coming across the border, rapists and murderers, and then he talks about Muslim terrorists blowing up things. What he is doing is activating an evolved psychological mechanism. And that evolved psychological mechanism, in this particular case, happens to have several different elements to it. One, it's fear of the outsider. But two, it's something a little bit more than that. It's something that's called the fire alarm bias. So what's the fire alarm bias? Fire alarm bias is when you hear a fire alarm, your nervous system immediately reacts. Your eyes widen, your nostrils flare, your hearing becomes acute, your heart starts to race a little bit, and you're on edge. And the reason is that's an evolved strategy for saving your life. What that means is that a politician like Trump can come along and he can push that button and you have an automatic reaction to it and you can't help yourself. You are going to feel something. But always, here's the optimistic message, always higher order cognitive thinking is allowable. So you can have your instinctive reaction, you can let it wash over you, and then you can sit back and say, wait a minute, that's not really in the context of things. That's not really the right reaction to have.
And the name of your book again?
Name of the book is Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Now to the movies, where a new film from Korean-American director So Yong-kim, Love Song, explores the complexities of muted desire between two longtime friends. International Edition's David Byrd reports the film, shown this year at the Sundance Film Festival, features actors Riley Keough and Jenna Malone.
Sarah, played by Riley Keough, and Mindy, played by Jenna Malone, are longtime friends. Sarah is married to a man who is never home, and they have a daughter. Mindy is a free spirit who seems to know exactly how to coax Sarah out of safety. When Mindy visits Sarah one day, she persuades her friend to take off on a road trip. One gets the sense that there's more than just friendship here, but the feelings between the two women remain subtly subterranean. The film jolts the audience with an abrupt end to the road trip, and then we see the two characters 3 years later, when Sarah is attending Mindy's wedding. It is there that Sarah finally confronts her feelings about her friend. If the relationship is not made completely clear, are they friends, are they lovers, are they friends who might want to be lovers, that's on purpose. Director So Yong-kim, known for her Korean language films In Between Days and Treeless Mountain, says she wanted to explore the evolving dynamics between the two characters.
I love love stories, and I wanted to explore an area that's kind of unusual, you know, and I wanted to tell dynamics between two friends who are women, and they're not necessarily, you know, one sexual preference or the other, but I just wanted them to explore what their relationship could mean, you know, and then fall in love, fall out of love, and try to navigate that.
Riley Keough, best known for being Elvis Presley's granddaughter, as well as her film work in The Runaways, Magic Mike, and Mad Max Fury Road, says that she enjoys working with Kim, particularly on character-driven stories like Love Song.
No, I worked with her on a short film we did called Spark and Light, and I worked with her husband on this movie, Jack and Diane, and so we've done, and this is the third thing I've done with them, and we're kind of really close, and they like to do things, you know, with people they've worked with before and very intimately and shoot out of their house. And, you know, I stayed in their garage, and that's kind of how I like doing things, and they do too. So it's fun, you know, when you find people that you like working with, you kind of, I think, just keep working with them.
The film is entered in the drama category at the Sundance Film Festival. It comes at a time when Hollywood is facing criticism for a lack of diversity in the Oscar nominees. Jenna Malone says the film industry is reflecting a societal problem, and only when society changes will filmmaking change.
You know, if anything's lacking in the film industry, it's because we're lacking it in society, you know. So it's more like we all have to come together and change before, you know, we can't just kind of put filmmakers up in a some golden box somewhere. You know, they exist because we put them there. You know, we need to tell different kind of stories. We need to evolve as a society, you know, and I think that's more important than being like, oh, we have to embrace all things female. It's like, no, we have to embrace all things human. And once we do that, it's not going to matter whether it's man or woman or black or white, you know.
Love Song also stars Rosanna Arquette as Mindy's estranged mother. Brooklyn Decker stars as a selfish maid of honor, while Ryan Eggold is Mindy's fiancé, Life. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Paul Kantner was an American guitarist, singer, and songwriter known for co-founding Jefferson Airplane, a leading rock band of the counterculture era, and its more commercial spin-off band, Jefferson Starship. He was born 74 years ago in San Francisco, California. Kantner had the longest continuous membership with the band. At times, he was the only founding member still in the band from the original Jefferson Airplane lineup, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with other band members in 1996. Let's listen for a moment to Kantner and the rest of Jefferson Airplane with Grace Slick singing their 1967 hit, Somebody to Love. Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government, through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, transferred the recently completed construction of the National Health Laboratory in Kampala to the Ministry of Health in mid-January. U.S. Mission Uganda's Chargé d'Affaires Trish Mahoney and Minister of State Chris Baryomunsi presided over the handover ceremony. The National Health Laboratory project began in 2012 when the Ministry of Health requested the assistance of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, to support the construction of a laboratory to address critical gaps in Uganda's health service delivery system. Funding for the National Health Laboratory construction came from CDC and the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. Construction began in 2013, and the more than $8 million facility is now completed and has been transferred to the Ministry of Health. The National Health Laboratory will play a key role in strengthening Uganda's health systems by providing a valuable resource for the detection, control, and ongoing surveillance of the diseases which affect the health of all Ugandans and influence Uganda's sustainable development. While the priority of this new facility will be HIV diagnosis, prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV, and viral load monitoring capacity, those suffering from many other health conditions will also benefit from this lab. The ministry's sickle cell and hepatitis B virus screening and the World Health Organization-supported meningitis, cholera, and typhoid screening program will make use of this facility. The National Health Laboratory could also be used for confirming bacterial disease outbreaks and for diagnosing malaria. This building represents our partnership with the people of Uganda and our commitment to helping Uganda build its future, said Chargé d'Affaires Trish Mahoney. We will continue to work with the government of Uganda and the Ministry of Health in the coming years to strengthen Uganda's health infrastructure and ensure it becomes strong, efficient, and self-sustaining.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.